Welcome. You're listening to the podcast where we interview founders innovating at the near frontier, whose companies will give you a glimpse of the future. Near Frontier is brought to you by Cantos, a venture firm that invests in world-positive deep tech startups at pre-seed and seed. To learn more, visit us at cantos.vc.
I'm Ian Roundtree, founder of Cantos Ventures and host of Near Frontier. I'm so excited for the conversation we're going to have today with Sassy Duggleby of Venus Aerospace, who spent some time at Virgin Orbit before founding this hypersonic space plane company. You heard that right. She's building a Mach 9 space plane that will ultimately fly military and civilians anywhere on the planet within an hour to an hour and a half. Absolutely mind-blowing. Let's go talk to her to learn more. So, Sassy, before we get into Venus, can you give us a brief history of supersonic flight and what maybe the differences are between supersonic and hypersonic and some of the different approaches that are out there?
Sure. Really, the difference in supersonic and hypersonic and even subsonic comes down to, you know, the speed of sound. So below the speed of sound is considered subsonic. And then when you get above the speed of sound, you know, you hear about the sonic boom. You cross that sonic boom threshold, and that's considered supersonic. And then once you get up above Mach 5 speeds, typically, so five times the speed of sound, that's what's considered hypersonic speeds. So Venus is, our goal is to travel Mach 9. So we are absolutely considered a hypersonic vehicle.
So there's a few companies out there that might be going after slightly supersonic, you know, like Mach 1.2, 1.5. There's some out there that might be going for Mach 5, just above the hypersonic threshold. But what you're saying is Venus is actually even higher than that.
Correct. Yeah. So Boom is aiming for supersonic, kind of a Concorde 2.0. I think everybody's really familiar with a Concorde. And then groups like Hermes are aiming for Mach 5. And they're using, you know, their engines are air breathers, so they have to fly lower. And the maximum speed they can get to is, you know, around Mach 5. And then Venus, because we're using a rocket, we can fly both higher and faster. You know, we could actually go much higher speeds. And you think orbital rockets, when you get into orbital speeds, it's up to Mach 26 to stay in orbit. But we specifically are aiming for around Mach 9, because that's actually where the space shuttle, when it would come out of orbit and begin its descent, you know, back to the United States, it actually came out of comms and started coming out of a comms blackout around Mach 9 or 10. And so we've realized that when we actually started out Venus, we were looking at Mach 12 to Mach 15 speeds, but we realized we'd rather go a little bit slower and be able to continuously communicate with our vehicle.
Is that because you're moving so fast that like radio frequency can't track it?
Yeah. So you actually generate a plasma field. And so you can't get radio frequencies through the plasma field that's generated when you're traveling that quickly.
Wow. So when you say air breather, well, the definition of a jet is you sort of, you intake air, you compress it, and you shoot it out the other end, and that generates your thrust. Some of the hypersonic Mach 5 range designs are sort of souped up versions of that. People say ramjet or scramjet or the typical designs, but what you're describing is something more rocket plane.
Exactly. It is a rocket plane. And so it's using a rocket. The thing that differentiates a rocket is that, you know, we carry our own oxidizer. So if you think, you know, if you want to go simple campfire 101, what do you need? Well, you need oxygen, and then you need a fuel. And so planes that fly lower bring in their own oxygen by just pulling in atmospheric air. But as a rocket, we can fly really high where there's not a lot of atmosphere because we're carrying that oxidizer with us.
And it sort of makes intuitive sense that if you're intaking air, there's some resistance there that it acts as a rate limiter with respect to speed. And so that's more or less the differential between Mach 5 and Mach 9 is that you're going from air breathing to propellant rocket-based.
Exactly. And I've actually heard like scramjets, I've heard the analogy is similar to lighting a match in the middle of a hurricane. You're just bringing air in so quickly and you're trying to combust it that it's just really hard. And thankfully there's groups making great progress on it. And I'll be honest, we're cheering them on. I mean, there's room in a world full of abundance. There's room for all of us. And so, you know, we're cheering Hermes on and other groups that are trying to build scramjets and Mach 5 planes or even supersonic planes. I mean, it's all exciting and all pushes forward on the future of aviation.
Yeah, that's helpful because I think a lot of people, they hear just supersonic and they think every airframe designing for those speeds is competitive, but there are different applications, different use cases for the different speeds, for the different sizes. And so Boom is predominantly going after a civilian market, like you said, a Concorde 2.0, whereas Venus, Hermes, some of you that are hypersonic are speaking with military, designing for military use cases. And we've heard a lot of talk in the public sphere. On Bloomberg, there was an interview the other day where someone was talking about hypersonics, and I get told that it's the military's top priority. Why are we hearing about this all of a sudden? And is it true that the U.S. has fallen behind Russia and China?
The stories that we've heard claim it's true. I mean, it's, you know, hypersonics in terms of, you know, weapon systems, you know, what happens with them is previous weapons are intercontinental or ballistic weapons where you fire it up, you know exactly where it's going to go and it's going to come down. And so we're really good at being able to knock those out of the sky. It just follows a physics trajectory. However, with hypersonics weapons, they can, you know, get up fast. They can move at speeds that we're not necessarily able to track. And so I think there's massive interest from the Department of Defense in terms of hypersonics. And all the stories tell us that, you know, China and Russia are ahead of us in those. One of the interesting things that Venus has found is, you know, reusable hypersonics is really what we're chasing. So whether it be a hypersonic drone or a hypersonic plane. And so it's been interesting trying to navigate the government world, because there's not a requirement out there that says we want a reusable hypersonic plane. You know, most of the requirements documents are still really focused on weapon systems. It's an interesting problem of trying to say, hey, we have something, but no one's asking for it. But when we tell them what we have, they're like, oh yeah, we need that.
So let's take a step back. Prior to launching Venus, you were most recently at Virgin Orbit and an entrepreneur before that. But tell us a little bit about Virgin Orbit and how that led to founding Venus.
We moved to Southern California. You know, Andrew and I are husband-wife team founders. We had a trailer manufacturing company in College Station, Texas that we were able to exit and kind of looked around and said, what do we want to do when we grow up? And Andrew is a huge space nerd and has always dreamed of propulsion systems, rockets, follows that closely, and had the opportunity to go work. It was at the time for the Launcher One group of Virgin Galactic. So we headed out to Southern California, you know, picked up the kids, and being open, I actually decided to stay home. Our girls were 3 and 6 at the time. And I was like, they're only going to be little ones. So I was at home. I'm not designed to be a stay-at-home mom, but I did it. And I'm very thankful that I did. And then Andrew was at Virgin Galactic, which became Virgin Orbit, as the head of propulsion R&D. So it was trying to figure out how to 3D print rocket engines. He worked on that for a couple of years. And then we actually deployed to Japan. So Andrew's in the Navy reserves and we got to go live overseas. 2018 was not the best year for the Navy. There were a bunch of wrecks out in the ocean and they had more ship repair than they needed. And so Andrew, in his Navy reserve world, is an engineering duty officer, which handles all ship repairs for the Navy. So we got to go live in Yokosuka, Japan at the shipyard. And that was actually where the idea of Venus came from. It was living overseas. We're actually sitting out on the balcony one afternoon or evening, kind of overlooking the U.S. fleet. And we were talking about, like, I was going to miss my grandmother's birthday party. And it wasn't that I couldn't get back. It was that it was 13 hours. And what do we do with the kids? And so we kind of were like, this is super ironic. Here we're spending all this time trying to send things to space, yet we can't even get ourselves home. And so living over there, that was the genesis of the idea of Venus. We knew this type of rocket engine was coming down the pipes. Andrew was watching it both at Virgin Orbit and just as a professor. And so we kind of had in the back of our head, hey, someday, like, this rocket engine put onto a plane could actually get us home. It could create, you know, a 1-hour global travel event as opposed to 13 hours to get back to Texas.
Yeah, it's funny that it takes less time to get to the International Space Station than it does to get across an ocean.
Oh, absolutely. So when we got back to Southern California, Andrew ended up going as head of launch operations for Virgin Orbit. And one of his friends there found out that I knew LabVIEW, which is a test software from my very first career days at National Instruments as an engineer. And they were like, wait, Sassy knows LabVIEW? We're desperate for LabVIEW programmers. Does she want a job? So I hopped into Virgin Orbit programming for the launch operations team. And then I spent about 6 months coding and I realized I needed to talk to people like these guys. No offense to coders, but you know, all day, every day, they're just writing code. And so I ran over to the business development group and started chatting with them and said, hey, here's my background. I have an engineering degree, an MBA. I've been writing launch software code. Do you need any help? And they said, oh, yes. So I split my time between launch ops and mission management group. And then we just kind of watched what was happening. And once we got Virgin Orbit to the very first demo launch, so, you know, launched the rocket from the wing of the 747, we knew it was time to go start Venus. So put in our resignation and then really started digging into the technology. We actually waited until we knew we had something there and we knew we had enough savings to say, all right, like we can sustain ourselves for about 9 months. Let's go see if we can actually fundraise and make this happen.
You referred to a specific engine design. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. Yeah, the engine that we are working on commercializing is called a rotating detonation engine. A standard rocket engine uses deflagration. So literally think you're burning a campfire and then sending it out as thrust. This engine uses detonation, you know, so grenade. And people get scared of, oh my gosh, detonation. I've actually heard people say like, are you really going to call it a detonation engine? But that's what the market calls it. And so anytime you detonate a propellant like a grenade, you get 15% more energy out of the exact same amount of propellant. And so this engine's been theorized for, you know, 30 years. And then several universities over the last couple years have finally proven it. And they've been able to measure the amount of thrust that they're getting and show that it is higher than your standard rocket engine.
And one of the hurdles is that, yeah, it burns a little hotter. And we won't go into how you manage it, but one of Venus's core technologies is an RDE that doesn't melt the walls of the engine, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, it's all about how do we keep it cool. And so with the increased thrust, you're getting higher pressures and higher temperatures. That means things want to melt and rockets are already on that bleeding edge of melting. And so most of our core technology really is, and our IP is around how do we keep this engine from melting so that we can use it, you know, thousands of times over and over again as we fly back and forth across the globe.
And then one of the other core technologies that you're developing is also keeping things cool enough, but in the body of the airframe, right?
Yeah. So when you fly through the atmosphere at speeds like Mach 9, Mach 5, whichever speed you're going, you know, you're generating an incredible amount of heat on those leading edges specifically. So if you think about the space shuttle, they had those ceramic tiles all along the bottom of them. After the shuttle would land, they would spend months, I think up to 9 months, inspecting those shuttles to make sure there was no cracks. And so we knew that that's not sustainable. Like you can't build a product of moving people every 9 months. Like, hey, great, that's, you know, that's a joyride, not a company. And so some of our technology is on how can we use standard materials, not crazy ceramics, in order to dissipate that heat that would then allow us to land and be ready to go 2 hours later. So, you know, while we might have kind of an ablative ceramic on the leading edges, that will only be so that we know that our heat pipe, which we're using to kind of pull the heat away from the edge, that we'll be able to know that, oh, maybe the heat pipe has failed, so we need to ground this plane. But otherwise, as long as that ceramic is still there, we can pick it up and fly again.
And so the concept of civilians flying on rocket power might not be new to some folks because SpaceX has said that this is one of the applications of Starship that they're thinking about. But what would be really special about Venus is that you wouldn't need to go to a launch facility to do that, right? I mean, you imagine going from LAX to Tokyo Narita.
Correct. Yeah, we actually believe that's key, is tapping into existing infrastructure. So being able to take off from a standard airport, you know, right now we're looking at using jet engines. So you take off with normal jet engines and then you get up away from city center. So about 35,000 feet over the ocean. And then that's where you turn your rocket engine on, because rocket engines are loud. You know, there's stories of, you know, windows breaking 5 miles away from an engine. And so we want to get away from city center. Then we turn on the engine, boost up to the edge of the atmosphere. About 170,000 feet is where we currently believe we'll be flying. And that point, we'll travel Mach 9. It's really called a boost glide system. So we boost up for about 10 minutes and then become a glider and glide across the globe. If you're traveling 7,000 miles per hour, which is what Mach 9 is, you can get from Los Angeles to Tokyo in an hour. So you'll bleed off speed, come down, pop your jet engines back on, enter into the landing pattern, and hopefully be ready to go again 2 hours later.
So the boost glide system is in that 10 minutes where you are boosting under the RDE, what's that sensation going to feel like to passengers?
Yeah, it should be similar to an airplane takeoff. So, you know, when you take off from an airplane, it pushes you in the back of your seat for about a couple minutes, maybe even 30 seconds. I don't know the exact time. And it will be about 10 minutes of that. So it's not like you have to be an astronaut with special training because your eyes are bugging out in the back of your head. You know, it should be a fairly gentle acceleration for about 10 minutes.
Experiencing how many Gs?
I believe it's about 0.5 Gs is what we're aiming for. You know, we could have some higher Gs if, say, it's still Team 6 and we need to get them across the world quickly and they're, you know, in the best shapes of their lives. But we're aiming to have a lower amount of Gs such that, you know, it's not crazy if average human can fly.
And maybe designing the seats around that a little to...
Oh, absolutely. There will be massive designs on how do the seats move such that, you know, humans are much better at taking Gs into their chest than they are at taking Gs down. And so how do we design the seats for the ideal arrangement? And thankfully, there's tons of research out of NASA on this exact issue. And then even some of the things with Inspiration 4, I mean, they've kind of showed you can take normal human beings that aren't, you know, the former Navy SEALs or, you know, test pilots, that quote unquote normal people can handle that type of experience.
So we've talked about the end game, the Mach 9 space plane that takes civilians across the world in an hour. But what does Venus look like today? And how do you manage the product roadmap that has both military and ultimately civilian customers?
Sure. You know, so up to this point, we would say that Venus is kind of a technology company. We had three key pieces of technology that we believed if these things are true, then we can integrate them into a hypersonic drone or a space plane. And so this most recent round of funding, we've kind of proven out like, hey, yes, we have something here. And now it's really kind of expanding our team to become, instead of just technology, to really have a full aviation company. So adding a structures group, adding avionics, but we're still early. I mean, we're about 40 employees right now. With the funding we just got, we'd hope to scale it to about 100, but I'm constantly reminding my team, hey, you can't build a space plane with 100 people. It's really, we're buying down risk. And that's why we have a drone. When we first started talking to the Air Force, we would talk about, hey, we're building a space plane on the development path. We're going to have a drone. And every person we talked to was like, wait, stop. Tell me more about your drone. And so there is incredible interest from the Department of Defense in a Mach 9 reusable drone. And so we've been able to leverage some grant money there, some non-dilutive capital, and are continuing to work with those entities to help bring that product to life. So really a drone's going to be our first product, with the space plane being our ultimate destination, because that's what we believe really changes the world. I mean, how does the world change if you can fly from one side and be on the other side of the globe in an hour and then get back home for dinner?
Can't wait. There are some design constraints, of course, when you're going that fast. And so ultimately, how many passengers do you see in a Venus space plane?
Right now, we're aiming for 12. And some of that does have to do with when your vehicle gets beyond 100 feet, it can start triggering some turbulent flow from the front of the vehicle to the back, and we need it to stay laminar. And so because of that, we actually think we might be able to expand further than that, but we're taking some engineering conservatism to say, let's stay smaller such that we don't have to deal with that turbulence.
So it would follow that with 12 passengers, it might be more in the class of flying private than even first class.
Exactly. It's more of a private jet size than, you know, the 747. You know, is there room as we learn and scale? I mean, there could be a version 2.0, version 3.0 as we learn more and can build larger size vehicles. But right now we're aiming for that smaller vehicle. And then even with the drones, they'll be much smaller than that. Kind of our development path is, you know, kind of building up drone sizes, getting larger and larger as we go.
So you're doing engine testing over the course of the year. When do you see first flight happening for Venus?
Yeah, so we started off our engine testing at a third-party rocket engine test stand at one of the main universities. And then we are currently standing up our own internal test trailer. And we say a trailer because it's literally built onto a trailer so that we can drive it around to different places to test.
I've seen it. Air conditioned and everything as it gets hot in Houston.
Exactly. So we have an air conditioned mission control kind of rocket van that then we attach to a test trailer that we can drive out and test on one of the dead end runways there at the Houston Spaceport. Then when will we actually get the flight? I would hope that our full scale space plane, we have it fully developed in about 5 years, but then we have to go through FAA certifications and that's going to be a long process. So I don't think it'll be anywhere before 2030 that we're really flying. But we can say that, you know, it took 7 years for Virgin Orbit to go from initial idea to first launch. And I think it was similar for, you know, the Falcon 1 at SpaceX. It was about 7 years from initial concept to first flight. So that's a pretty consistent plan. And that's full approval. We're just talking first flight without even approvals. That's, you know, running an experimental aircraft.
Oh, heck, the 787 was, I think, 8 or 9 years to approval. Yeah, airframes take a while. And so when you've alluded to your new funding round, congratulations on closing your $20 million Series A, led by our friends at Prime Movers Lab, who are seed investors as well in Venus. When you're pitching investors, but you're pragmatic about the timelines for pulling this off, is it about finding investors with longer timescales? Or do you spend a lot of time talking about what meaningful revenue might come in the door before you're at the ultimate rendition of the Venus space plane?
It's absolutely both. We definitely needed investors with patient capital. I mean, you don't build a space plane in a year. You know, it's not like we're an enterprise SaaS software where we can hire more and more developers and throw them in a room and then spit out this incredible $1 billion unicorn. So it took us a while, even on our initial fundraising journey, to find investors that weren't scared of longer timelines, of hardware, of folks like yourself. And so both patient capital is of the utmost essence, but also showing that we have opportunities for early revenue. You know, our rocket engine alone can send, you know, 6 times the amount of payload to space. So finding partners, we have no interest in being a launch company. There's 101 launch companies out there. You know, building a space plane is truly what we believe changes the world. But there's opportunities to find the right partners to, you know, to sell or license our engine to. And then, you know, the drone is obviously a very early revenue path for us. You know, the Department of Defense is very interested in a Mach 9 reusable drone. So there's avenues there. And then the space plane, I mean, at the end of the day, there's estimates that that's up to $300 billion per year for high-speed global travel. So finding patient capital that says, all right, we'll spend $1 billion to get to $300 billion per year. I'll take that trade any and every day.
Yeah, absolutely. And obviously when you're building for military, you're not necessarily going through the full FAA approval process that may be expedited for those revenue lines, right?
Absolutely. I mean, there's especially with the drones, you know, that's one of the reasons the military is very interested is if you can have 100, you know, smaller scale drones that don't have humans on board, that's very alluring to the military as opposed to going and buying one, you know, really expensive F-22 that, you know, you get that thing shot out of the sky. You know, there goes a massive amount of capital.
Right. Yeah. Most of the cost is coming from the triple redundant systems to make sure that you don't, understandably, that you don't lose a human life. With unmanned systems, burden of proof is lower.
Right. And we'll have the same systems. That's one of the great things about this engine because it is so much more efficient than your standard rocket engines that we do have room for triple redundant systems and safety that a standard rocket engine just doesn't provide.
Absolutely. Yes. I didn't mean to allude that the passenger vehicle would not, but that it's easier to get a unmanned system in the sky.
Oh, absolutely. And we can learn tons. I mean, the more hours under flight, you know, the more we learn. And so the faster we can get a drone into the sky that's flying out over the Gulf of Mexico, the faster we learn. I mean, as we've seen Elon do so well with Starship, like crash it, learn, and then keep building as opposed to making a bunch of assumptions. You know, one of our rocket engine test engineers, he's on our test team. You know, he always tells the story. He was early SpaceX and they were really worried about what would happen. Like a nut or a bolt got pulled off, you know, the engine and somehow got sucked in And so they actually designed an experiment like to drop a bolt into the chamber to see what would happen. It was like, it only dropped thrust like 3%. I mean, it was some really low number. And so he's like, you know, sometimes our biggest worries aren't the things that actually go wrong. And the things we're not thinking about are where you go wrong. And so the faster you can get some sort of MVP out there and start testing it, the faster way to learn.
Yeah, probably wouldn't have been able to do that test at NASA or ULA. You know, I think it's shocking that in the current environment, if it weren't for SpaceX, we would have NASA and ESA astronauts potentially stranded on the ISS, because since the closure of the space shuttle program until Crew Dragon in 2020, we were going up on Russian rockets. And if it weren't for SpaceX, they could potentially be stranded there just because, you know, one guy in Moscow decides that he doesn't want to give you a ride.
Absolutely.
Anymore.
I mean, yes, very, very thankful for SpaceX. And we kind of joke, I mean, there's SpaceX University now. I mean, you think of the number of rocket scientists and aerospace engineers and deep tech factories, and I mean, the knowledge that has been generated because of both Blue Origin and SpaceX on how to really build rocket programs. I mean, I think all of these new space companies are taking advantage of that. I mean, it's created, so I think all of the innovation that you're going to continue to see in the space world, and even not even just space, but fusion and really the deep tech world, that comes from the training that has come out of SpaceX and Blue Origin and some of these groups that are pushing kind of the next frontier and saying, no, there's better ways to do this than cost plus government contracts.
Oh, yeah. I do want to get into that. But just on this SpaceXU point, I've recently invested in two teams that came out of SpaceX working on climate tech, and have met with six or seven more, most of whom are working on things like fission, fusion, batteries, other hard tech that is more Earth-oriented than orbital, lunar, Martian-oriented. And if there are any SpaceX engineers listening to this podcast, we'd love to talk to you if you're thinking about starting a new company. But it's been really incredible to see the talent coming out of there. Maybe as that organization has gotten to 2,000 some odd people, they're sort of looking for something that looks like the early days of SpaceX again. And Venus has benefited from some of that talent, as you point out. What's it been like recruiting from Houston? Obviously a storied aerospace ecosystem there, but you know, there's a lot of talent in LA as well. What's it been like recruiting from Texas?
All of our original hires were mostly people we knew from our network. You know, kind of the, we were able to get just great folks, both from Virgin Orbit, but other, you know, from grad school. One of our vice president of research and development was one of our buddies at Virginia Tech when Andrew was doing his PhD and I was doing my MBA. And so, you know, we have a premise that if you're not touching hardware, like if you're not building the test stand right now, you can work from anywhere. And so we've been able to pull in a bunch of remote propulsion engineers. Like they're actually doing the design work, but they don't need to be, you know, I think if COVID has taught us anything, you don't have to be in the office. You can do great work remotely. And so if you're touching hardware, we're recruiting you here to Houston. And Houston comes from both aerospace, and you think of all the oil and gas and just the hard tech that exists here in the city. So that's been pretty easy to recruit for. The other thing is, I mean, we're building a space plane. Is there anything cooler to come work on? Like really, what, if you're an aerospace engineer or you're into rockets, or even if you're just an engineer, or like we've been interviewing like accountants lately. And when I ask, like, why do you want to do this? They're like, this is the coolest accounting job I've ever seen. You know, I get to come do accounting for a company building a space plane. Like, that's just super inspiring. And so we haven't had any issues recruiting to Houston. I think some of it, we have found Houston to be really collaborative community. Everybody's open and wants to help out. I mean, we are friends with astronauts. I think that's probably one of the strangest things is that, you know, astronauts' daughters go to school with my kids. Or I coach a soccer team and one of the daughters on our soccer team, her dad was an astronaut. And so we pick up conversations. And that's just normal life here because they live here. They participate in the community. And so they're always like, they're super interested in what we're doing. So that's been really fun.
Oh, it's so cool. And you've got the NASA Test Pilot Training Center right there at the Houston Spaceport.
Oh yeah, there are two doors down from us. So the T-38s fly daily. In fact, I'm kind of surprised on this podcast you haven't heard a rumbling, because they fly in and out all the time. And then we actually have the Texas Air National Guard is down on the other end of the hangar, and they've got a set of F-16s that they scramble weekly. And so it's super fun. I mean, we're literally sitting in our office and all of a sudden, you know, the whole world vibrates, and sometimes we'll run out, see what's going on. Different planes fly in and out all the time. So.
Well, I won't out the price, but having portfolio companies that have hangars in Southern California, I can tell everybody listening that Venus's lease is significantly cheaper.
Yeah, that was another reason we moved. I mean, we knew that if we stayed in Southern California, which has an incredible amount of aerospace and rocket knowledge, I mean, it's a great, great place to be a rocket company, but it's expensive. And we also knew that there's no place in, the only place to test engines is out in Mojave. And we lived that life as almost a split family. I was kind of a single mom for 2 years because Andrew was head of launch operations. Well, where do launch ops happen? They were out in Mojave. And that's, you know, 2-hour drive, but that's with LA traffic, which, you know, so that's laughable at 2 hours. We knew we needed to find a spot where we could, you know, our vision's home for dinner. I said earlier, our vision's home for dinner. And so we want to be able to test rocket engines and be home for dinner, and want to be able to fly you to the other side of the world and have you home for dinner. And when we started looking, I mean, we actually did a search of the entire United States of where do we want to set up. And someone actually said, hey, have you looked at the Houston spaceport? It's the only urban spaceport in America. And we said, no, we didn't even know Houston had a spaceport. And we got introduced to the team here and kind of flew out and said, here's what we want to do. We need a place to fire rocket engines. We need a place to fly drones, and we need a place to fly experimental aircraft, and then ultimately full-scale commercial aircraft. And the Houston spaceport, they're like, yeah, you can do it all here. So it's been awesome. I mean, and we have folks that live urban. They live in downtown Houston in a high rise, and it's a 20-minute commute to Ellington Field. And then we have folks that live on acres of land out in the country, and it's a 20-minute commute for them. So you can kind of have the best of both worlds. And then even the thing that people don't realize about Houston is it's actually the most diverse city in the United States. So there's incredible food, there's incredible culture. It's got, you know, the world's best hospital systems. And so it's been a great home for us. And I can tell you, our kids are really, really happy in school here. So it's been a good move.
Well, and you're in a really cool part too, in Southeast Houston, where you're a little closer to the Gulf too, if people want beach time. And when I was there visiting in November, I hadn't been to Houston in probably been almost 10 years. And I'm just shocked at how large it is. I forget. It's like, it feels like you're in LA when you look out at the cityscape.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's the fourth largest city in the United States. It's giant.
Yeah. And a lot of development there. It was exciting to visit. Thanks for hosting us. So you alluded to it. You've spent a lot of time thinking about culture, and we talk a lot with our portfolio founders about culture building, but it's a lot harder in practice. You've made a concerted effort to focus time there, and it's paying dividends. But can you tell us a little bit about that?
Absolutely. So it's a couple pieces. Number one, I was the oldest female engineer at Virgin Orbit when I was about 39. And that's not that old. It's like, so I would look around the room and be like, where are the other females? What has happened in aerospace that, you know, there's a plethora of young 20-something female engineers, and there was like a few 30 something, but by the time you get to my age, like there was literally none. And I think I was mentoring, you know, practically every young female engineer. They'd come and be like, hey, can we have lunch? Can we chat? And of course, and that's one of my favorite things to do. But when we were starting Venus, we knew there just had to be a different model. We wanted to be able to, you know, hire, and it's not just females, but hire families. We know we're on a 10-year journey for Andrew and I. You know, our kids, by the time we're done with this, aren't going to be living in the house. And if we work 100-hour weeks and we're not with them and we're not watching them grow up, then what's the point of it? And so we named the company Venus for two reasons. First, she's the only female planet. If you look at all the other planets, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, they're all male names. Venus is the only female. And then also she's the goddess of love. And so we wanted to create a company where we want to love our people well. Like we want to treat them whole. We recognize they're whole humans, that there's things going on outside of the work that they need to take care of. And we want to empower them to be their most creative selves. And we feel like if you're working 100 hours a week and you're exhausted, you're actually like, you're not at your best. And we have 1,000 problems we need to solve. And so we need you to be at your most creative such that you can solve these and solve them well. And so we put together recently what we're calling the Venus flight plan. And it's really kind of who we are as a company, how we execute. And it's great because it rolls into everything. Like we move at Mach 9 speeds. We want to eliminate the drag, get back home, enjoy the flight together. We want to celebrate our wins. It's, you know, if we're on this journey and we just, you know, it's an infinite game. If you talk about Simon Sinek. And so it's like, if we don't stop and say, no, this is a huge win, whether it's a small test that goes well or raising a $20 million Series A, it's just super important to build a culture. And we believe at the end of this, I tell people all the time that if we've built a space plane, but we've done it by beating our people into the ground and they haven't enjoyed the journey, then I truly believe we've failed. I just think there's a different way to do things. I think aerospace was born out of war. If you really want to look at it, it came out of, you know, World War I, World War II, Vietnam, the space race. It's been a constant deluge of like, we're at war, get back to work, salute the flag. And not that we don't salute the flag. I mean, we're a military family, but we just feel like there has to be a different way to do it. And so far it's, I mean, we're able to attract great talent. We want to be able to keep our talent. Yeah. It's just, we think there's a different way to do it. And we're trying our best to make that happen.
It's really amazing. You do have a standout culture from more traditional aerospace and from some of the other now not startups anymore, but the other private companies that are a bit newer. Do you have any tips in addition to what we've covered already for maybe founders listening out there that are just getting a deep tech company off the ground? Maybe they haven't even raised their first round of funding yet. Any general tips about finding investors and finding the right early team members?
Sure. I would say, no, it's going to be really hard. Like you have to have grit. You know, it's, I think Andrew and I tracked, and I think we stopped tracking pitches at 180 conversations, you know, so don't feel like you're going to go pitch five people and you're going to get your money. It took being consistent and, you know, also focused of who are the right people that want to invest in deep tech. It takes a certain type of investor. So, you know, if you're a consumer goods related investor, you have zero interest in a space plane. So, you know, being able to find those people, I think just knowing, like, if you have a great idea, like, and you believe in it, there is also an investor that believes in it. All you need is one yes. Like you could have 180 no's, but if you get that one yes, then you're good.
Yeah, I was actually, I mean, I'm ashamed to say it now, but when we first met, I told you and Andrew no. And, but you know, you were so gracious about it and clearly thought through everything. And admittedly, I had some misconceptions about a couple of things that only over time did I come to realize that I had it wrong. And then I came back to you a few months later with my tail between my legs, and you were gracious enough to accept a Cantos investment into your seed round. But I just, talking to you was so thought-provoking, and I honestly just enjoyed speaking to you and Andrew that I couldn't shake it and kept thinking about it. And that allowed me to wrestle through some of the things where I was maybe a little more skeptical and came back to invest. And so, you know, when you said have grit and be persistent, yeah, it pays off even when you might initially get a no.
Yeah. And, you know, the other thing I would say, Ian, is that we had our initial pitch deck and it looked like it was designed by two engineers. And we had someone say, hey, you should pay for a design. And I did not want to pay for that. I thought that was ridiculous. But they finally convinced us that if you're building a brand and building a deep tech company like we are, like it would be worthwhile to have a designer build the deck. And so we went ahead and pulled that trigger. It was not cheap, but our fundraising, I feel like from the time we had our original deck to when we got this professionally designed pitch deck, it was a drastic change. And that's when we really got our traction. And that's when we finally got the funding. And I know probably as an investor, you would say, oh, the pitch design doesn't matter. It's the story, it's the founders. But I do believe for us, it helped us look far more professional and have a more cohesive story. And at the end of the day, as a founder, you have to be a storyteller. You have to be able to create a vision. And, you know, investors are trying to invest in the future. What's the next unicorn? What's the company that's going to get us this return that for our LPs? And so being able to cast a vision and tell a story that you are the right founders for this exact problem is probably one of the most important things you can do as a founder.
Absolutely. I similarly, like you in the early days, was a little skeptical of this, but I've come around a full 180
such that we now occasionally will subsidize engagements here and there for things like deck design is a little cheaper, but like outright branding, like when you're not going to have a product in the market for many years, but you need to attract talent and partners and capital and press in the interim, there is a greater urgency to paint the picture of the future that you're building. And I've seen incredible dividends paid sometimes for branding engagements that I scoffed at the price of because, you know, they were working with a top agency or something, but then it dramatically accelerated all of those things, fundraising, BD, recruiting, press. And, you know, there've been cases where, you know, I know of some engagements that were like upwards of $250,000 for the full branding package from a top tier firm. And then in relatively short order, they ended up raising nine figures, $1 billion round. I think about Commonwealth Fusion Systems, which we're not an investor in, but they rebranded as they were raising their $1.8 billion round. And let's say they paid $250,000 for that branding engagement. That's pretty high ROI.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think also, you know, especially if you've got deep tech founders there out there that are really technical, you know, they're going to be the more engineering type of founder. Like, I feel like even within our organization, sometimes our engineers kind of scoff at like, oh, you're going to pay that much for branding? Like, does branding even matter? And I was like, oh no, you've got to look at the company as a whole organization. And yes, the technical stuff is important, but I mean, there's so much more to a business than just the technical aspects.
Well, Sassy, usually I ask people what the big, wild 20-year vision is for the company, but we've gone into that in detail. My favorite closing question is, if, when Venus makes you and Andrew billionaires, what are some things you think you'll do with the money?
I would love to invest in other female founders, especially deep tech female founders. There's not a lot of us out there. And so being able to pay that forward, I had some great women that helped teach me how to fundraise, and I would like to do something similar. I'm sure we'll, you know, Andrew's, you know, never has a lack of ideas. You know, one of the things that makes him so genius is just his brain runs all the time. So I'm guessing if, you know, Venus has planes flying all over the world, there will be other steps that, you know, if we've made $1 billion and we have that money in our bank account, there'll be some other crazy idea that Andrew has that he'll go chase. You know, one of my jobs as his wife and co-founder is to keep him focused. It's like, nope, space plane, like focus on the space plane. Like, let's get this one working first, and then you can go work on your next crazy idea.
Well, I love it. You know, once Venus is established enough, there can be a R&D lab and continue doing that in Venus. And with respect to helping early stage deep tech founders, it's been great to work with you as a advisor to the new Cantos Fund, which we'll announce soon. So hopefully it's a little opportunity to get started on that path.
Oh, absolutely. So we're still thrilled to have Cantos as partners and, you know, really appreciate, you know, what you guys do for us and what you're doing for the deep tech ecosystem. I think there needs to be more deep tech investors out there who have the vision like what you guys have.
I agree. But we've got some great peers, and Prime Movers Lab is a great example of a firm that's relatively new and is putting a lot of capital to work in things that are really important for the world, and, you know, are already proving that there's exits. They've had multiple companies go public in a relatively short time period. Sometimes I have to correct people that we are not, in fact, funding basic research. And I've started using the term near frontier, the name of this podcast, to remind people that as crazy as some of this technology might seem, it is actually feasible within a decade in most cases. And it's been really encouraging to see some publicly traded companies. And, you know, I hope that trend continues. I like to think of deep tech as industrials companies before the tech risk is taken off. And there's like this arbitrage point, or narrative arbitrage that happens where when you're still de-risking the tech, people call it deep tech and it seems really esoteric, but I've seen this multiple times. All of a sudden, when you build the thing, like your first purchase order could be nine figures. If you're very careful to build something that you know needs doing and isn't just incremental, then it can have this really stepwise trajectory. And we're seeing that in our own portfolio and broader deep tech ecosystem. So I am so excited to continue watching you and Andrew and the team build Venus. And if other people want to follow along, what's the best place to find you?
Yeah, our website is, you know, venusaero.com. And I think we're on Twitter and all the standard social world.
Amazing. And we'll link to your website and socials in the show notes. People can find you there. Thanks so much for taking the time today, Sassy.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Ian. Appreciate it.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Near Frontier. Links to external content mentioned are available in the show notes and at nearfrontier.com, where you can also find other episodes of the show. To leave feedback or suggest future guests, you can find us on Twitter @Kantos.